Microsoft Research came out of a discussion between Bill Gates and Nathan Myhrvold. He was the chief science advisor to Bill Gates. Rick Rashid was pursued as the founding director. I think that was 1991. We were brought in as the first AI group. There was a specific call out to the gains and contributions we had made with probabilistic or Bayesian inference. And that approach resonated deeply with Nathan and with Bill, per what Nathan was telling us at the time. When we came up, we were probably within the first 10 people, three of us, at the lab. There was a group that came over from the IBM Research Center in Natural Language Processing, and there was a small compilers team at the time. Microsoft Research grew very quickly in its first few years. We spent a tremendous amount of time recruiting. And it was interesting, I remember back then, to even think about what it would be like to build a lab. We established certain principles. For example, this amazing principle that there would never be any controls on a researcher's decision to publish anything they thought was important to publish. There would not be a tower of reviews on that process. And that has stood the test of time. That really has given the labs quite a different feel than you'd have in a traditional corporate R&D environment. The lab grew to comprise all areas of important areas of computer science over time. And people at the lab would do a mix of applications as well as foundational work.
Welcome to another episode of NEJM AI Grand Rounds. I'm Rajman Rai, and I'm here with my co-host, Andy Beam. We have an amazing conversation to share today, and it's with Dr. Eric Horvitz, who is the Chief Scientific Officer of Microsoft. Eric told us about his work at Microsoft, which goes back several decades, including how he got started at the company all the way to his work on AI today. Andy, I know this word is overused, but I think Eric is truly unique in being both a card-carrying MD and a PhD computer scientist who works not just at the intersection of the two fields, but who's made fundamental advances to both fields on their own. As one example, he wrote the classic machine learning paper on a Bayesian approach for identifying spam email, and he's leading efforts at Microsoft now to understand the strengths and limitations of large language models like GPT-4 in medical diagnosis. We had a really wide-ranging conversation spanning medical AI, decision theory, and computer science, and it was a lot of fun.
He's also done really interesting things like the 100-year study on AI, where he gave a donation to Stanford to help them study AI over a century time horizon. That's the kind of long-term, forward-thinking projects that have been the hallmark of Eric's career. He's also on something called PCAST, which is a White House-level organization that advises the president, and one of their key mandates is advising the White House on sensible AI policy and sensible AI regulation. The number of areas that he has touched in computer science, medicine, and public policy has been very impressive.
The NEJM AI Grand Rounds podcast is brought to you by Microsoft, VizAI, Lyric, and Elevance Health. We thank them for their support.
And with that, we bring you our conversation with Eric Horvitz. So Eric, thanks for joining us on AI Grand Rounds today.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Eric, great to have you on AI Grand Rounds. So this is a question that we ask all of our guests. Could you walk us through the training procedure for your own neural network? How did you get interested in AI, and what data and experiences led you to where you are today?
It's an interesting reflection for me to go back and think about all that. I have always been interested in mechanism. I've sought explanations for things in the world. How do they work? And that led me to doing a biophysics degree as an undergrad. I was excited about learning about physics and biology, chemistry, how they come together in various ways. And during that time, I ended up getting more and more curious about this interesting black box we call nervous systems, in particular human nervous systems. Intrigued me what the heck was going on and who were we. And that led me to a neurobiology lab, and I did a deep dive. And, you know, when you're an undergrad looking at neurobiology, you get placed into very specific segments of research and questions. And I was becoming expert at looking at single neurons, unit activity, building microelectrodes, pulling them, as they say, and sticking individual neurons. And in dark rooms, I'd watch the clicks and clacks of single neurons. And that raised my curiosity even higher, how on earth did even a trillion or 100 trillion of these little units generate this fluid conscious experience that people have? And then when I was applying to grad schools, I pursued a PhD in neurobiology and thought I would add an MD that would give me more depth and the future possibility of working more with the grand challenge of understanding human minds. And by the time I got to Stanford to do an MD PhD, I was already so intrigued at the modeling approach, the AI approach to getting around the mysteries and complexities of dealing with many, many neurons and trying to build larger understandings from the activity there. And I started taking lots of courses on main campus, grad courses in AI. And before long, I moved my PhD over into AI at the foundations, at the principles level. And then later came back to Ted Shurtleff's lab doing AI in medicine. That seemed like a nice unification, even though I stayed on the more on the principle side, probability theory, decision theory, and so on, of principles of bounded rationality. But I found an interesting direction, which was how do you apply formal methods, bringing decision theory and probability theory into what was then the dominant paradigm of AI in medicine, rule-based expert systems, as they were called. There was such a lot of excitement about those systems. But they didn't seem to handle uncertainty very well. And by pushing into probability theory and trying to bring that back, I would say, to AI research, ended pushing me into understanding better what we meant by bounded rationality, systems that can't possibly do it all. They can't possibly finish thinking when it's a hard problem, like a trauma care problem under time pressure. What do? And coming up with the formal methods for how they would back off and become bounded rational in a way that was justifiable became kind of a passion of mine. And that led me into broader areas of AI research.
Can I hop in here and ask a question? Because I'm super intrigued by the sort of scientific origin of your interest in AI. So you were trying to understand from a neuroscience perspective how intelligence arises. I wonder if you see any parallels in what's happening now with trying to do interpretability of large language models or other big complex. There's a movement right now called mechanistic interpretability, which is essentially applying like neuroscience principles to large language models. How promising do you think that is in light of your experience in
neurobiology? Well, popping up a level, it's interesting. So here I was making in some ways a crisp decision at a point in my career that I would not be pursuing the complexity per the black box of nervous systems, heading into the world of Bayesian networks and more generally probabilistic graphical models where you knew the semantics, you knew the procedures, you knew every arc and node. Getting into machine learning, it got a little bit more complex and black boxy, but still understandable. And as we got into the world of neural models, neural network models, and now today, it's interesting to come full circle and say, well, Eric, you couldn't escape. You're back in this world again where you're grappling with complexity of the form we can't understand and explain very well. Some of the most interesting behaviors that we're seeing now, some people refer to them as the emergent behaviors of abstraction, generalization, and composition that we see, for example, with GPT-4. So here we are back again. And now I find myself in recently working on a paper that's coming out at iClear, you know, where we're thinking, looking at what happens, looking at the actual activations of single neurons and patterns of neurons when a system can answer a problem versus when it can. And I had to sort of giggle to myself saying, you know, Eric, there's probably going to be no easy way into the world of understanding deeply mind or even our small versions of flickers of minds we're seeing in these large-scale language models now. And so tools like that you referred to just now as mechanistic analyses and explainability, understandability, I think would be more and more important. It's almost like here we are in 2024. And if you'd asked me back in 1989 during grad school years, what would I even be doing in 2024, let alone would it look like the Jetsons in that futuristic world? This idea that we'd be back again and I didn't escape my pursuit of clarity and crisp understandings with the complexity we've now encountered and also the incredible capabilities we're seeing at the same time, I would be shocked probably to learn about this back in 1989.
Yeah, I thought that hearing about your early days, the symmetry just popped out to me from where you started to where you ended up. Everything old is new again. So I don't know if that is exciting to you or frustrating that this problem has followed you over the many years, but it seems to be like you are kind of back to where you started.
I guess I would say that as we pursued the path that I was on, we'll call it for now probabilistic and decision theoretic systems, where we would, and the representations, Bayesian networks, influence diagrams, foundations of utility theory in medical AI systems, for example. Not to geek out the listeners here, but the idea of doing cost-benefit analysis under uncertainty, doing diagnosis with methods we understand quite well. And by the way, those methods have reached a point where they're quite mature, and we should not forego looking at them very carefully in their applications to healthcare while we're in the superheated time about neural language models. But that to the side, there is a sense of excitement, to answer your question, in that it didn't seem we were going to get to anywhere deeply close to what we see in like vertebrate nervous systems on the path that I was on. We have methods that will do tremendously well in being competent collaborators when it comes to healthcare, sort of more precision in our diagnosis and our therapies with those methods. But now, with what we're seeing now, I'm not going to say that we're necessarily getting closer to how minds work. But let me just say I see a path to being surprised about large-scale systems and interactions with tremendous amounts of training data and certain principles by which we train models to discover new surprising capabilities that I didn't see on the path that I was on. So I'd say I'm surprised in that way. And I'm delighted.
Yeah, it's certainly easier to experiment on a virtual brain than it is on a real one when you're trying to understand how it works. I guess, too, I'd like to understand a little bit more about the MD side of your training. So I think clearly you have an interest in intelligence and AI. It sounded like the medical training was in service of those scientific goals. But did you do residency, for example? And sort of how has the clinician side of you informed your career?
Yeah, when I first came to my doctoral work, my MD PhD program, like other medical first and second year medical students, I dove in with my class. I was a full, vibrant member of my 4-person cadaver team in anatomy, physiology classes. But at the same time, I was like staying up late at night and spending all my day also going from my anatomy class smelling of phenol into my AI classwork, and people looking at me like, what's that odor on your body? Where are you coming from, man?
In my experience, that odor's not that uncommon in computer science classes. So maybe you weren't
it that. Maybe a different place. Odor. But anyway, but back to the question. I stopped out after like a couple clerkships to really go full bore my doctoral work. And I got so into it, Most people in the world still know me as a researcher in AI, and many are surprised with, wait a minute, you have an MD? And the story with that is that I got more and more interested in clinical medicine through my AI applications and talking to physicians, the experts on teams and so on, getting more immersed into that world from the point of view of trying to build systems to be competent and to be helpful on those challenge problems. I finished my PhD work. In the meantime, a colleague and I started a startup company that was actually taking some of our PhD work and actually making clinical tools on this new thing that was getting more powerful called a PC. That company evolved into a larger scale company that we started taking our medical principles of Bayesian networks and decision-making to other areas, like to United Airlines for jet engine diagnosis and to NASA for space shuttle monitoring and so on. And right around this time, Microsoft, a strange company to the north of the Bay Area, reached out. It was Nathan Myhrvold, a close associate with Bill Gates. And we heard news that, we're trying to start a research team. And we're really interested in the research you're doing and in your company and so on. Of course, we were stunned that, why would this company that makes Windows 3.1 and a word processor and a spreadsheet be interested in even a research group and let alone AI technologies? That's a whole other story about where Microsoft Research came from and our work there when we came up. But we ended up being acquired, and I promised my two colleagues I would stay no longer than 6 months. That was 31 years ago. And when we made that deal, I hadn't finished my rotations yet, my clinical clerkships. I was so passionate about my PhD work. And I told the folks at at my two colleagues, Jack Breeze and David Herkerman. Hey, look, you go up immediately. I really want to just, I've gotten more interested in clinical medicine. I want to just experience the whole, I want to do a deep dive into this area. I had like 10 months to go to finish up everything given my earlier clerkships. And I just dropped everything, got completely focused. And I remember even like the tension between like finishing up writing journal articles based on your dissertation with like holding a clamp during pediatric surgery and thinking, oh, do I really want to be here? But I started really getting into it as maybe a more mature person. Like I started to love clinical medicine. I wanted to excel in every rotation that I did, you know, get those top-notch recommendation letters and, you know, recommendation for house staff when you come back and all that. But in the end, I did a very rare thing for most MD training programs. On my last day of my last rotation for my commitment, it was September and the sun was setting on a kind of cool fall day. I got into my car, went to my locker first, got all my stuff. And I drove away without doing a residency. And I always felt like, oh, like it's really difficult to do that kind of thing. But I made my decisions where I'd focus my attention. But per your comment, the clinical experience has proved to be extremely valuable, especially when it comes to, and I don't mean to, I know both of you didn't have your MD, but you're doing lots of work in AI right now, in AI and healthcare. When it comes to talking to AI scientists, who are largely in their labs, like they have no concept of some of the actual real world problems. And you know, why is it so hard to like translate this really cool technology into practice and to having been there and understanding daily life and the workflows? It gives you a different appreciation for like how hard it is to really innovate and to bring the innovations into the clinical realm to make a big difference.
I totally agree. And I was fortunate, so I did a PhD, not an MD, but during the PhD, it was kind of a medically themed PhD in this sort of unique program between Harvard and MIT called HST, where we take a good chunk of the first 2 years of preclinical coursework and then, even more importantly, spend two summers in the clinic, taking histories and physicals, rounding with the teams, presenting cases. And I think I really, now I'm looking back on this, if and when we are clinically relevant, I attribute so much of it to sort of that time that was spent just learning about how decisions are made and working with clinicians, building real collaborations. And so, you know, you have this, I think, as Andy said, very unique background. You're a card-carrying MD and a serious computer scientist. I think it's a pretty rare breed. I think it's interesting to think, especially in GPT-4 era, post-GPT-4 era, what education for quants and AI researchers to help them be clinically relevant will look like. I think that's a good point to actually transition to some of your work, Eric. So we want to dig into your work at Microsoft and your research there. And I think you mentioned this a few moments ago. You, as I understand it, you helped to start Microsoft Research, and you've been at Microsoft for a few decades now. So maybe we could start with telling us about the founding of Microsoft Research and some of your work on foundations and applications of AI and maybe human-AI interaction as well as some of the themes that you work on.
Yeah. So Microsoft Research came out of a discussion, from my understanding, between Bill Gates and Nathan Myhrvold, who was, you might call him the CTO of the time. I don't think he was given that title at the time, but he was, you know, a chief science advisor to Bill Gates. And they have a beautiful set of slides, which I think are available, which was like, why is a research lab important? What would be the nature of Microsoft's research center and so on? That was, you know, remarkably, they were remarkably important slides and thoughts for how to, for framing Microsoft Research. Rick Rashid was pursued as the founding director. I think that was 1991. When our team was approached by Nathan Myhrvold, who was doing passionate recruiting of core initial teams, we were brought in as the first AI group. There was a specific call out to the gains and contributions we had made with probabilistic or Bayesian inference. And that approach resonated deeply with Nathan and with Bill, per what Nathan was telling us at the time. When we came up, we were probably within the first 10 people, three of us, at the lab there was a group that had been came over from the IBM Research Center in Natural Language Processing, and there was like a small compilers team at the time. Microsoft Research grew very quickly in its first few years. We spent a tremendous amount of time recruiting. And it was interesting, I remember back then, to even think about what it would be like to build a lab. We established certain principles. For example, this amazing principle that there would never be any controls on a researcher's decision to publish anything they thought was important to publish. There would not be a tower of reviews on that process. And that has stood the test of time. That really has given the center quite a different feel than you'd have in a traditional corporate R&D environment. The lab grew to comprise all areas of important areas of computer science over time. And people at the lab would do a mix of applications as well as foundational work, combinations thereof. On our team, we started out being called the decision theory group because we were so excited about that at the time as a foundation, including probability theory.
Eric, can I love to dig really into decision theory, but I suspect that many of our listeners actually don't have too much familiarity with decision theory. So could I just interrupt you for just a moment to give maybe our clinician listeners, other folks who aren't as familiar with decision theory, an overview of what it is and just your definition of decision theory.
So there's decision theory and there's decision analysis, which is the engineering real world incarnation of how you apply decision theory on real world problems. It goes back to the idea that the foundations of modern approaches to what are ideal decisions goes back to probability theory, the axioms of probability, and on top of which the axioms of utility or utility theory. And that's another set of assertions about preferences, about what's good and bad in the world, what are desires under uncertainty. But an important test area or an application area for decision science more generally has been medicine. Hard medical decision problems where you face a set of outcomes under uncertainty. You have a set of actions that one might take. There are different likelihoods of different outcomes happening following each of the actions that you might commit to. These are irrevocable commitments, decisions in the world. And the idea is, how do you discover the best action to take when there are cost-benefit trade-offs or the outcomes are quite different with potentially great uncertainty? And so there are processes by where you frame the decision problem, which is, what am I trying to do here exactly? What are the what are the goals? What are the key possibilities? What are the actions possible? What's the disease process in this case, in a particular case, for example? What are all possible outcomes of each action that might be taken? And then for each outcome, even before you get there, you can sort of try to really push on a patient's preferences. Like, what does this mean for the patient? If I do this kind of prostate therapy, surgery, radiation, what are the trade-offs? And then how do I choose the best action, especially given that there'll be uncertainties in what happens because you can't know for sure. So decision analysis is the engineering approach to taking those principles of decision science or decision theory and bringing them to life. And they typically involve notions of estimating probabilities, computing expected values to come up with the best decision, which is typically an expectation given the uncertainties. A lot of us do this kind of thing qualitatively in the clinic. Just by looking at literature, thinking through the key actions and outcomes we care about, and then talking with the patient to understand preferences and looking at best practices and protocols and making a call. Typically, it's to be the patient's decision, of course. But sometimes you have hard problems that you really are hard to, you need to have work on paper and pencil. And when it comes to bringing AI to bear or to leverage our AI technologies, we want to have systems that can give us estimates of the probabilities of the outcomes and then understand how to encode preferences of patients, for example, and then propagate them through to tell us what's the expected value expected utility of each action that I might take, and let's pick the best one, but make sure that that really resonates with what the patient has in mind, preferences. As we get into talking about large-scale language models, one of the interesting challenges is, what's the role of these models when it comes to working in a decision theoretic or decision analytic way, which is the classic best practice or approach for hard decisions and making calls on the best action to take? And that's going to get, that gets into this, these questions about, can these large scale language models really give us probabilities, for example, that are credible, that are well calibrated? So questions are coming up at the, you might say, at the intersection of traditional best approaches for how you harness AI to do hard decision problems and what these systems now can offer us in terms of their powers we're seeing, which are remarkable in themselves.
So I think when I first seriously got into decision analysis and decision theory in grad school, I was just blown away that there was so much thought and that it was several decades old when I was starting to go through this and how to formally reason over diagnoses and over patient utilities, formally elicit utilities, and then come up with rational decisions and also collect information in a very principled way, right? Even what tests to order, what utilities need to be measured, things like this. And then I was struck, so I remember discussing this with Zach, who's my PhD advisor and, you know, our editor-in-chief of NEJMAI. Mm-hmm. I remember discussing with him, I was like, you know, like, why isn't all of medicine like this right now? Like, why aren't clinicians formally eliciting utilities and estimating probabilities and applying Bayes' rule and doing this and that? And, you know, it started this sort of multi-year discussion that has, of course, not resolved, but is extremely entertaining and I think also informative about the sort of difference between some of the theoretical frameworks and then the practical demands on the clinician who has a very limited amount of time and is maybe informally doing some of these things, but not approaching with all this machinery. And so I have to, you know, I think when we think about the sort of population health level guidelines that are set by some of the national organizations, I think they do take very formal decision theoretic approaches to making clinical recommendations. But for this sort of individual clinician seeing the patient, it seems that large language models, that GPT-4 and its cousins, may actually solve some of these fundamental problems that have seemed very elusive, right? Or at least offer a path to solving some of these problems around both the provision of information, although of course there are many limitations, as well as the kind of interaction with an individual to collect utilities in a formal way. Do you see decision theory potentially having some type of revival with the advent of large language models?
You know, we have work to do. I should say that my team got access to GPT-4, an early raw version of it, as part of our responsibility to do safety studies for Microsoft. And we started, that's when this work that led to this paper called Sparks of AGI came from. We started looking at this these models. And of course, you know, you can imagine I would be diving in with all sorts of hard challenge problems in healthcare. And I even pushed the systems back in those days. Just on the topic of your question, can a system be told, you know, the chain, we'll use these fancy terms now, chain of thought reasoning or other methods, other prompting methods, to think with Bayes' rule, to explicitly to use probabilistic reasoning and tell me what it was doing on a worksheet? Could it then do decision theory? Could it do what we call hypothetical-deductive reasoning in a loop, where we look at the symptoms? It's a phrase that's been used, that's used over the years for you look at some initial signs and symptoms, formulate a differential diagnosis, a list of diseases by likelihood. Based on that, compute, you mentioned this earlier, you know, the expected value of new information. What's the value of, and sort by the expected return of collecting new information, given the cost of making that collection, and then getting the new information and going in a loop, hypothetical-deductive loop. Could I drive GPT-4 to do this kind of thing? And did some early experiments in this. It was so interesting to even push hard on getting these systems to openly show their knowledge of probabilistic reasoning, because they've read about it and they've learned about that kind of thing. And to, you know, keep track of prior probabilities and posterior probabilities. You can imagine these classic chest pain examples. 45-year-old white male, no history of cardiac illness, comes in clutching his chest with pain that he's never had before in his chest. I also tried it with in her chest because we want to look at gender issues and statistics and so on. But having the system write down its reasoning from the point of view of Bayesian updating, Bayes' rule and so on. And the system, you can see it struggled. You can see steam huffing and puffing, but it was making progress in this space. It wasn't always correct in some of the calculations. We know that's not the strength of these systems. But to me, I'll use the word again, spark. There was the sparks of the prospect that someday these systems could explicitly be tuned and trained and call other tools, for example, when they needed to do calculations they couldn't do themselves, or preference assessments, to become fabulous companions as decision analytic consults. And so I'm hopeful. You can tell that our team, we're still exploring, I'm personally still exploring the possibilities. I'll ask questions at times, to even OpenAI. Hey, can we have these systems better calibrate their probabilities about X or Y? And can we get into the log probs and see how we could sort of do some research to make these systems more competent at Bayesian diagnosis? I think let's listen to this podcast 15 years from now. I'm guessing that we'll see an incredible synthesis of what we call traditional Bayesian inference and decision theory, decision analytic consultation, and large-scale language models. I mean, even now there are some basic things we can do that are just no-brainers, like framing your decision problem. What am I not thinking about? What more options might I have? People often say in a decision analytic problem, whether it be in healthcare or finance or in public policy, that a new option or a new consideration of an outcome can dominate the whole analysis. So on that front, if we believe that, and I think we're seeing signs that large-scale language models really can be, let's just use the phrase, mind-expanding for humans for what they can do with their, well, use another word, with their polymathic skills, their ability to compose and synthesize and bring in information and ideas and distinctions that one was not thinking about when they first started sketching out even a traditional decision tree. I think there'll be lots of touch points.
So you have a term that I think I've seen you use before, instead of the history of present illness, right? It's the history of future illness, right?
Yes.
Which is this sort of simulated possible future states, which is both a wonderful potential educational tool, but I think also a new way for physician to consider maybe things that they haven't considered that don't necessarily align with their differential so far. So that's super interesting. So, you mentioned also that your group has done work on evaluating GPT-4 on medical challenge problems. I think you had a preprint, maybe it's amazing also just how fast this field moves, right? How the progress has moved from January of last year to now. But I think it was a preprint in the first half of last year on GPT-4 on medical challenge problems. You had found that GPT-4 performed very well on USMLE style questions. I think you had exceeded the sort of state of the art at the time. And then perhaps, I thought that paper was very interesting, and perhaps even more interesting to me was your group's work just a couple months ago on prompting and how effective something which seems simple, but is increasingly, we have this very rich evidence base, is extremely important for eliciting the behavior out of these models that we want for a given task. How chaining together a few different techniques into this kind of meta technique that you call MedPrompt really unlocked certain capabilities from this generalist model, GPT-4, on challenging medical questions. And so anyone, I've also noticed that GPT-4 users and other language model users, they sort of seem very strong kind of bubble effects where some people are using the model every day for hours a day. They almost have a relationship with the AI, and other folks have used it once or twice, maybe tried to use it as kind of a Google device to look themselves up, were not impressed and didn't really use it. But anyone who's used it a lot knows that prompting really matters and how you sort of craft your interaction with the model really matters. So from that standpoint, it's not surprising, but I think what's surprising when you start to learn about it is what you actually do. And so some things like saying think step by by step, right? Which you call chain of thought. Or I think for another one of the models, it's take a deep breath.
Take a deep breath. That's my favorite.
Yeah. So I literally, you know, Andy and I are both fathers of young, young children. And it's literally the same advice that we give on a new task that our daughters are learning. I think my 6-year-old was jumping in the pool and I was like, take a deep breath and think about how you're going to do this. And it's literally what seems to work with some of these models. So maybe we could just take just a couple minutes and then I think we want to jump into sort of your efforts on responsible AI. But maybe just on that MedPrompt paper, could you just tell us about maybe briefly about the background of the paper and then what your findings were, and then maybe also just like signal where you think this field is moving. So what those results mean for what's coming next.
Yeah, so the background on that paper is, of course, the team under my office, the Microsoft research teams we're very close with, have been looking, you know, since we've been playing with large language models, at the power of, in some ways, the power of how we communicate with these models. It's so interesting, given how they work, to understand how powerful it is to set them up to be generalizing or synthesizing or abstracting or composing based on subtleties in language of how you describe who you are, your role, and what it is that you want, and how you characterize the nature of what would be a good answer or output in this whole dialogue as the dialogue continues.
I think Greg Brockman from OpenAI has put it in a very pithy way. He said, a surprising amount of AI research is getting large language models to be in the right mood and saying the right prompt and coaxing them to sort of be in the right headspace is where a lot of the engineering effort actually gets applied.
It's interesting.
English is the hottest new programming language.
And it's amazing how powerful language is. We're discovering the incredible foundations of how concepts are embedded and how language is used and the meaning of words and how they're strung together and then encoded and then represented and then reasoned with by these models. I'd say the right mood or the right mode. Even saying things like, one way that I've used GPT-4 lately is as an expert editor. So I like to write my own stuff. I don't like to have the system generate like the content for me, but I don't mind having the system. And actually, you know, sort of enjoy and I'm very thankful when something's an important document that I've written or a few paragraphs that I want to do a post to take a look, you know, to have GPT-4 take a look at what I've done. And the way I do this kind of human AI collaboration session is to tell GPT-4, you are just such a talented, insightful editor in how you can take my material and really find places, you know, precision places where you might want to refine it and it can even be better than it is. Put those comments into angle brackets. Don't touch my text directly, but give me expert editorial remarks because you're just so great at this. Really, really thanks so much. You know, the expression of this camaraderie and appreciation for the kind of capabilities the system has. I haven't done a formal study of this, but I find myself not doing that just because I'm anthropomorphizing, because I want to squeeze top-notch performance out of these systems. And in some ways, per Greg Brockman's comment, it's putting the system in the right mode/mood. And I think we'll learn more about this over time. But what's interesting in the MedPrompt work, as we call MedPrompt, is, and you said stringing together, composing, we're at a point now where we have notions of few-shot prompting or learning, different ways of doing that, random, based on similarity metrics. Then there's the idea, you said, chain of thought, like reason about your steps. Then there's the notions of ensembling and shuffling and ways to combine different answers all in a single prompt to come up with the best answer, looking for consistency. And so what we did with MedPrompt is we took several of these known methods and did a very careful layering of them and then going backwards, ablating them to see what was each component now adding to the power or the accuracy of the results we were getting, for example, on the MedQA, very challenging medical challenge problem benchmark. The MedPrompt work itself was kind of a fun experience in that it came out of what we called the MedPrompt Marathon, I think I talked a little bit about this publicly, where we just said, hey, we have a bunch of smart people. Let's get together and we're going to have teams. And we're just going to really go for it with some dedicated resources. We can get fast answers. Sometimes having a cluster so you can really cycle fast helps you think and be creative. It was interesting to see how far we got with that, to be the top scores on not just the medical challenge problems, but we went to this interesting large-scale set of benchmarks called MMLU, which has challenge problems in philosophy and law and electrical engineering, psychology and accounting. And we said, wow, this MedPromp thing with these layers seems to be pretty general purpose. Well, we'll still call it MedPromp because that's its roots. But we're kind of learning about, you know, how in 2024, what are some best practice approaches to talking to these models? Some of the magic that we discovered with the MedPromp work was to actually use the model itself to do chain of thought and to generate the few shot reasoning. You know, write your own chains of thought as examples. Seem to be as good or better than humans could do with creating sample chains of thought as examples. That was pretty exciting to us. And it suggests that, which is coming to the fore now in multiple research projects, that these models can play multiple roles at different phases of problem solving and prompting. And this in some ways frames work now on these multi-agent solutions like AutoGen, where it's really the same basic language model, but you're giving it different roles as a programming construct and telling you're the critiquer, you're the generator, you're going to, you know, work, check in with the human and so on, and building sets of agents to take on various aspects of the problem solving. But one more thing about the MedPromp effort, you know, we were seeing a lot of special case expert-driven models going on where we explicitly in our initial paper in the first half of last year, our original work on the USMLE challenge problems, we explicitly said, we're not going to try hard. We want to basically show you how powerful these language models are by just talking generally and asking for answers to these questions the way anybody might ask without doing any hard work. And that was the magic of what we were demonstrating. You know, then we saw some competing groups saying, hey, we're doing a lot better than you. We worked really hard at this. We brought in 30, 35 experts. And we said, you know, we were like sitting on a chaise lounge smoking a cigar. And that was the point. But, you know, we'll lean in now. We'll do a little marathon and we'll just explore the space of what you can squeeze out of these models by talking to them properly. And that's what some of the background there.
What's your intuition for how much farther we can go, Eric? So I think you got up to 90% there. Do you think just prompting on GPT-4 can push us another 5%? There's something to unlock in the model that we haven't unlocked in prompt space?
You know, I'm sure there is, but the question is, what are the margins of return with effort right now?
Yeah.
I think when it comes to these large benchmarks like MMLU, all the medical portions of it, or MedQA, at some point, some of that remaining headroom is not going to be better thinking, but we discover, oh, that's really a bad question, or those answers were inconsistent in the benchmark. So we'd find some froth that's really not going to get better by being more brilliant, but by debugging the actual benchmark itself.
Nice. So I'd like to transition to your work on the responsible AI. So you've had both a private sector hat and a government sector hat in both of these in this effort. I'd like to sort of touch on both of those. So continuing with your work at Microsoft, I don't know whether or not this counts as Microsoft or not, but you've stood up this 100-year study of AI. So I'd love to, one, hear about the genesis of that, what we hope to learn from a 100-year study of AI, and what you hope comes out of that.
Yeah, the 100-year study on AI, by the way, it's we call it that it's kind of catchy, but the endowment to Stanford that our family did to stand up the 100-year study on AI is to have a report written with proactive guidance to government, civil society, the public, academia, every 5 years for as long as Stanford exists. So as John Hennessy told me, we can guarantee this will go on as long as Stanford exists. At the time, he thought that would be a pretty long time. So it's probably, hopefully it's more than 100 years. The background, the genesis of that study was that when I was president of the Association for the Advancement of AI, this is the largest society of professional and scientific researchers in the world, the AAAI, we're having the upcoming main conference coming up in a couple of weeks that I'll be at in Vancouver. But when I was president in 2008 and 9, I made the theme of my presidency, because it was just coming, AI was coming of age. Even with applications like the readmissions work we were doing at the time, for example, in real hospitals and testing things out, I made the theme of my presidency, AI in the open world. And when I gave my presidential lecture, which is still online, it was all about, like, we have to sort of think through the principles and mechanisms, it gets back to bounded rationality, but how can we design our systems to do well in the open, in the scruffy, uncertain open world and still be robust and reliable? And I talked about different ways to do that and so on. But the last part of my talk, I said we have to also start thinking about AI people and society and its influences in the open world. And some people thought that was like way over the top in 2008. But I called together and I announced at that lecture a study that would go on for several months that led to a meeting at Asilomar for symbolic reasons. We went to Asilomar, called the Presidential Panel on Long-Term AI Futures. It was just this great study with top-notch people. You can go online and read about who was there and so on back in 2008 and 9, because it spanned those 2 years. And in 2014, it was 5 years later, and I said, we should do this again. That was so useful, but things are changing so quickly, even back then. How can we do this again? And of course, as a computer scientist, we think about induction, n gets n plus one. And how can we do this forever every 5 years?
You just have to establish the base case and then
exactly. Just watch out for recursion. Yeah. But anyway, so we basically went to Stanford. The development office thought we were a little bit out of the box and called the president in. They were all kind of wishy-washy. I don't know if you can do this or not, and we can guarantee this will go forever. John Hennessy, who I've known for many years back when he was teaching, when I was at doing grad school, said to me, Eric, this is a great idea. Let's just do this. You know, it's funny because then just maybe 7 or 8 years later when we were standing up and I was helping on the advisory board for the human-centered AI, HAI program at Stanford, we had a big opening dinner and John was at my table and he looked at me and he said, remember back a few years ago, we all thought this was crazy? Well, I guess it was just a few years ahead of its time. But anyway, that study is now going into its third report. I recently mentioned, God, 5 years seemed like an appropriate, you know, base cycle back in 2013 when we stood this up. Maybe we should speed this thing up. I mean, in terms of the recurrence on that. If you go online and go to the 100-year study site, you can go to my initial document, what's called the framing memo, where I listed 18 issues, challenges and opportunities that I thought would stand the test of time. Like hundreds of years. Mm. So maybe folks, your listeners can go out there and take a look at
those. We'll go in and check on those annually. And
yeah, see where we are with these things, right? Because they're all kind of like, I thought, really raised questions about possible futures, you know, in 2013. And I think they still do. Anyway, in part, it turns out that study and it's the news about that came back to Microsoft. And people start talking about it at Microsoft. I mean, in discussion in email, Satya and Brad Smith mentioned we were doing this. And we all started talking about, like, what's Microsoft's point of view on responsibility in AI. Satya called together a meeting and we started thinking together about what were our principles about AI as a company. And this work led to what we now call Microsoft's AI principles. There's six of them. And the standing up of what was called the Ether, and is called the Ether Committee, which stands for AI Ethics and Effects in Engineering and Research, which ended up defining and scoping out our earliest approaches to what the company would be doing when it came to our responsibilities, when it came to the development and fielding of AI technologies.
Before we get you to the lightning round, I want to ask about your role on the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, or PCAST for short. So this is a not specific to AI Council, if I understand correctly, but a large focus of PCAST recently has been on AI, and you've helped advise the Biden administration on the executive order they released. So I guess, to the extent that you're able to answer this, how is the federal government thinking about AI and AI regulation?
So the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, PCAST, has been a fabulous experience for me in terms of the colleagues and the collegiality and the various projects and working groups that I've been involved with or contributed to. One of the projects people out in, I'll call it NEJM podcast space, would find very interesting is we finished and made public, after about a year and a half of work, our report on patient safety, calling for a transformational effort in patient safety with a set of recommendations to the president. So we do a variety of projects. I'm just coming off of co-chairing a project called Cyber Physical Resilience for the Nation. That's just was posted just last week, and you'll see that there's quite a bit going on with opportunity in that space. Yes, AI lit up the White House with interest. It lit up the Office of Science, Technology, Policy, which is the housing organization for PCAST. There's been a great deal of engagement. The PCAST group briefed the president directly more than once on AI. I've been very much involved with those briefings. And we were engaged at multiple levels, including levels of collaboration that had influence on the president's executive order on AI. There's both concern for the need to regulate and to guide, but perhaps even more so, interest in making sure that America and the world more globally harnesses AI for great benefit. So those are coming together right now. And in some ways, there's a sense that if we could appropriately regulate the technology when it comes to safety, for example, and rights, and some specific concerns like, let's say, biosecurity-related issues, we're freer to innovate and to get the most on the positive side of AI innovation at the frontiers.
I'm going to try and be a real podcast host here and tie this back together to something you mentioned earlier, which is decision theory. So you'll see people on both sides saying that there is infinite benefit from AI, but also infinite harm. And so it's almost kind of this weird Pascal's wager situation where doing a sensible cost-benefit calculation is almost impossible by definition. So how do you actually reason about cost-benefit of AI, if not in the short term, then over the long term, when you have these kind of infinities that crop up according to people on both sides of this debate?
Well, I think many people who are working in this space aren't necessarily pinning their needles to infinities. They're somewhere more in the middle and looking at, for example, the downsides as potential rough edges versus the end of the world. It comes down to, you know, our democracy works in that we and our elected officials and advisors get to work together in a collaborative manner to think through the various inputs and possibilities, to study them. It takes wise committees, and I say wise because you can't necessarily converge on the ideal answer, but you can do kind of a decision analysis and say, look, we're seeing these kinds of benefits. Here are some concerns. Maybe we can monitor them over time and learn about them. Maybe we could check back. You can do some limited previews. We can do red teaming. What are some techniques that would provide some fail-safe dimensions to AI technologies and how they're being used? What are the key concerns from the point of view of different stakeholders? For example, if you ask me, what are the biggest concerns with AI going forward? The two that come to mind for me are the two challenges are the flooding of the use of AI to flood the world with synthetic media, including nefarious uses of the technology to persuade and to impersonate, to generate propaganda. These are, I think, are significant threats to democracies.
There was a recent example of a fake Biden robocall in the primary in New Hampshire where they cloned his voice and had a very convincing robocall of telling people not to vote in the primary.
Right, that kind of thing. And of course, we track that very closely. And we're don't just folks are just sitting on their hands. Our teams and other teams have been very interested in, for example, media provenance technologies, mm-hmm. watermarking technologies. These were mentioned front and central in the executive order. Some of these technologies were based, on my team and came out of our groups at Microsoft, and are now being shared in larger coalitions like the Coalition for Content Provenance and Authenticity, C2PA, c2pa.org, if you want to read about that work. So in the context of the elections coming up around the world over the next 12 to 24 months, there's lots of interesting work going on right now among multiple organizations as to how to grapple with the prospect that AI could be used to disrupt. The other area I'm interested in and concerned about is biosecurity. I mean, the AI-powered protein design and bioscience more generally is going to be game-changing for healthcare and for just even understanding the foundations of biological systems. It also can put new powers in the hands of malevolent actors to generate new toxins, for example, or gain-of-function research. We need to basically stay on top of that and come up with the right kinds of approaches to, for example, screening DNA synthesis in new ways and updating those screens over time. So there are mitigations and directions for research on mitigations that are possible on all fronts of concern that we need to make investments in. At the same time, we have to really lean into, maybe with some courage, exploring the upside to not be paralyzed. Clearly, this technology is going to change so many aspects of life. I often say, I don't want to scare people, but to me, it makes me excited that, 500 years from now, the next 25 years will be recognizable as a named period of time because of AI advances. It's up to us to guide that technology. We can't shut it down or stop it. It's part of our natural curiosity, our science, but so are the guardrails. And so is our democratic world's approach to grappling with the trade-offs and doing, back to your comment, even qualitative decision analyses, like what do we want to try, what makes the most sense, will be the best thing for populations of people, for different stakeholders.
All right, so I think that's a good transition to the lightning round. The lightning round is where we're going to ask you a series of questions. Maybe serious, maybe goofy, maybe funny. We'll let you decide whether or not you think they're serious or goofy, and the goal for the lightning round. Okay, so the first question is, Microsoft has a lot of big AI for science initiatives, and as you just mentioned, drug development is one of the most important applications for AI. So the question is, can you see a day where Microsoft ever makes a drug?
We would make drugs but not produce them. In other words, our folks would be pursuing new approaches to antibiotics and pharmacology as part of their AI for science work. But the idea of making the drug and distributing it would come through partners. We're kind of a platform and research organization. And I see us not competing with pharma, but supercharging, helping pharma to be supercharged.
Got it.
We should have a drug, Anyway, yeah. Good question, though.
All right. Here's our next lightning round question. Eric, if you could roll the clock forward 5 years, what are Microsoft Research's major contributions to the field of biomedicine?
I would say that our contributions will be new tools that enable drugs to be discovered and tested in simulation. And the other direction will be, we will see advances that will ideally bridge wet labs and the in silico world by giving in silico techniques the ability to call and design experiments that they need to push forward on advancing.
So is that like automated lab? Is that sort of like a full stack AI automated lab?
Full stack automated science with humans in the loop, of course. But there's been a really interesting long-term prospect that, going back to our decision science conversation, expected value of information, can AI systems really use their curiosity to drive the experimentation to collapse uncertainty by looking for the information they need through experimentation and guiding that process? To me, that would be just a beautiful supercharging of science more generally.
Got it. So you've obviously been thinking about AI for a long time, and I think what we've learned today too is that you're nothing if not a true Bayesian. So I think going back 20 years from now, or going back 20 years from today, what about your world model of AI has been updated the most in light of evidence that you've gotten over the last 20 years? So what beliefs that you held 20 years ago needed the most updating today?
My answer to that question would be that the biggest updates I've received happened in the last year and a half over large language models and what I consider the magic that they're showing, which suggests to me that what's going on with unexpected surprises and capabilities might somehow be related to the surprises we see in the magic that comes from large-scale tangles of neurons.
Will doctors still be responsible for documentation in 5 years, or will generative models like ChatGPT have taken over that task?
I certainly hope the latter will be true. I still want physicians to be in the driver's seat. I want to celebrate the primacy of their agency, and I believe that human touch and human connection will be even more important with the rising sea of automation.
So I think you have survived the lightning round, Eric. Congratulations.
Okay. Yeah.
So I don't know if you've noticed, but I've been trying to dance around the Sparks of AGI paper because I wanted to save it for the end. So now I'd like to revisit that. So you and Sebastian Bubeck and other collaborators at Microsoft wrote this paper with a provocative title called Sparks of AGI, where it was really like the first in-depth look at GPT-4 and its capabilities. So I guess AGI has a certain connotation and comes with certain implications for better or worse. I've always said that if you say generalist artificial intelligence, no one cares. But if you say AGI, people start to really want to debate you. So why did you feel that GPT-4 had hit or was worthy of this, somewhat hallowed term in the history of AI? We used to talk about narrow AGI versus AGI. What about your interactions with GPT-4 made you thought that it was ready to be called AGI?
So many people in AI research, serious researchers, have looked at the term with raised eyebrow, AGI, which came kind of late 90s, early 2000s, because we always thought we were doing AGI. In other words, we always thought we were pursuing principles of general intelligence. That's the idea with AI research. In fact, Herb Simon's 1959 project with Alan Newell and others was called General Problem Solver. That was the original GPS in my readings. And so we said, okay, we get it. So people, many of whom came from outside the serious, I'd say, central AI research community, said, you know what? I see successes with narrow AI, like that, Eric, that readmission system, or that system that can predict which patients will get C. difficile, in 48 hours. That's narrow. Look at humans, what they can do, all these abilities. We call that more general intelligence, and we should be pursuing that. Now, it's not that AI research wasn't pursuing that deep down. It was just that we were having some successes on the narrow front. So we were kind of like, yeah, we get it. Okay. Now, AGI also became associated with kind of doomsday scenarios of visions of Terminator, and this is what the rise of AGI would mean. But if you go back to the early definitions of AGI by people that were using that term, they were calling out as general a set of abilities as people have. And they would, and we actually searched around as we were playing with GPT-4 as part of our study. Sebastian and I in particular were trying to figure out how to frame the work. We wrote that first section together about how do you frame this work? What do you bring AGI in as a concept? And we talk in the first section of that paper about the history of the use of the term, just like you're asking me now, why we thought, let's use that term because it really does mesh with the initial intentions of that phrase. And we don't need to go down the path of changing it to generalist AI or something like that, because it has been defined quite nicely in different ways that are quite similar to what we're getting at now. Now, I felt it was important in the title to not say first contact with artificial general intelligence or it's here now. Because my perspective was we were seeing glimmers, like true sparks, like a snapping arc in places and at times that were like bowled us over. like, wait a minute, like, what's going on here? This is really impressive. And it does have a number of the capabilities that people have talked about for years. Let's just come out of the shadows of experimentation with the system, show the examples as to why we're seeing these sparks, and look at these 72 sparks and their cross links. Now, for me, the sparks included, I have examples in what's called the AI anthology online of some of the examples I played with early on. But even the fact that these systems could see when they weren't trained on imagery, like I was drawing faces in, you know, with ASCII and talking to the system and, you know, yeah, I see a face there. Then I would change it into a little lunar lander just by editing. And the system would say, well, I see a face, I think, still. I said, no, that's a lunar lander. Oh, I'm so sorry. Why did you say face? Well, you know, faces are so common. And so these systems were like almost like having dialogues, even about things that they weren't necessarily trained to understand, learned through language associations over time. Over the training corpora. So I can go on and on about this, each spark that came to our attention, but the biggest word for me was polymathic. I'll use that word again, like the ability of the system to weave with fluidity across different disciplines and combine things together and do synthesis really was the main sparking arc for me in coming up with that title.
So I agree. I think if you don't view AGI in a quasi-religious kind of way and you just look at it in the strict technical definition of the word, it seems very hard for me to argue that it is not a general kind of intelligence.
I guess so we were basically, in some ways you might say, we were claiming that term back. We were calling it back from the quasi-religious and saying, let's get serious about this. This is computer science.
Yep. And I guess, but so then there's still the qualifier of the title, which are sparks. So I guess the question that I'd like to ask you is, when do the sparks hit kindling and become a full roaring fire? How far are we away from that?
It's hard to know.
Do you think it will happen in your lifetime?
I think it's safe to say, from my point of view and what I've been seeing, that the next paper like this won't use the term sparks. It'll be a different construct to capture a more comprehensive set of capabilities we'll be seeing. So I expect surprises that are exciting in my lifetime. And this is what my career has been all about. We're getting to this point now where, as I said, we're coming full circle back to the deep interest in what neural nets were doing. Was at the foundations of our own cognitive substrate, and I think we'll be learning a lot from these systems that has implications for that, as well as learning more generally about principles or the physics of intelligence.
All right, Eric, well, I think that's a great place to end it. I think we've come full circle, so thanks so much for joining us on AI Grand Rounds.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure, and thanks for all the great questions and conversation.
Thanks so much, Eric. That was great.